Dwayne DeMario Mero versus Commonwealth, Mr. Hayden.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
All right, then we'll be glad to hear from you.
May it please the court, I represent Dwayne DeMario Mero, who was convicted in a bench trial in the Newport News Circuit Court of one count of aggravated malicious wounding, one count of use of firearm in the commission of that felony. He received a 18 years with 10 years suspended. We've assigned as error that there was that no rational trier of fact, there was no rational basis for a fact finder to reasonably conclude that the alleged victim, Shanessa Pittman, sustained a permanent and significant physical impairment, since the victim herself did not appear at trial. The judge never got a chance to observe her. There was testimony of a neck injury that had occurred.
Were there any photographs and evidence aside from the ones that had bandages over the injuries?
I don't think so. And if you look in the exhibit on the appendix on page, I think it's 120. I might be mistaken about it. Page 106. We looked at that there was a police detective goes and takes a picture of the victim 10 days after the shooting has occurred at the hospital and takes the picture, and you don't even see the injury. It's covered up by a bandage. You can't tell what happened there. The judge never got a chance to observe the injury. There was no medical doctor who appeared to say, well, this was a permanent and significant physical injury. It's never going to go away. It's going to be visible scarring for the rest of it. The judge, all the cases that the Commonwealth cited at the hearing, at the trial, the Hawkins case, for example, the doctor, Commonwealth versus doctor, all those cases, the judge, there may not have been medical testimony present, but at least the judge got a chance to view the injury and say, well, that's clearly permanent. You know, when somebody suffers it's reasonable to conclude a permanent injury without medical testimony. If you have somebody confined to a wheelchair or he's had a section of his intestines removed, you don't need a doctor for that. But here,
Mr. Hayden, can I refocus a little bit, because I'd like you to address that, the other assignment of error, the general sufficiency that the defendant was the gunman, for want of a better term. The statement of Pittman came in without objection as to it being hearsay and without any request that it be used only to either impeach the witness, or for some purpose other general evidence. It seems to me that statement, having come in, provides sufficient evidence to support the trial court's conclusion that the defendant was the gunman. Tell me why that is wrong.
Well, for one thing, the person who gave this. We're referring to a statement of the sister, not the victim, right?
Correct.
Jaleesa Pittman. She gets on the stand at trial and specifically repudiates the statement. Says it was.
But that's not the point, though. Judge Petty's point is simply that it came in without objection. Whether it should have come in is not before us, and apparently wasn't objected to at trial.
Right.
So it came in, and the question Judge Petty has, which is my question as well, is since it came in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, why doesn't that satisfy the other elements?
Well, certainly where you don't have where that's the only evidence that the defendant committed this offense, a statement that's specifically repudiated by the witness.
Except the trial judge weighed the information, the evidence in the statement against her trial court testimony, and he specifically concluded that the statement was more believable and adopted that and rejected her in-court testimony. He can do that. He can reject all or any part of a witness's testimony that he deems appropriate. So that having been said, reading that statement, doesn't that statement establish the defendant did the shooting?
Well, that was the basis that the judge relied on, and certainly there's arguably some factual basis that the judge relied upon. It's a pretty dubious one, but nevertheless, the judge
is able to, and
that's why I really have not focused on that as my lead argument.
Well, I'll let you move on.
Let me then follow up on the earlier point that you were talking about, which is, assuming we agree with you that the Commonwealth's evidence regarding permanent and significant physical impairment is lacking, is the remedy to remand for resentencing on malicious wounding as opposed to the aggravated malicious wounding, or a new trial?
Well, I would think a new trial in this case, because certainly there's just simply not evidence of to support the conviction of the charged offense, and that was
aggravated. No, but the question is whether the lesser included offense of malicious wounding is supported, and what we do about that.
I mean, the Supreme Court has given us the choice of, not us the choice, but the parties the choice of either remanding for a proven lesser included offense or remanding for retrial, and unless both parties agree for resentencing, it goes back for retrial. So that's the reason the question's being posed.
Well, we're not agreeing to just simply resentencing. I note that the judge made his conclusion that there was a permanent and significant injury. The court says, he says, I had a question about permanency, but the case cited by the Commonwealth would appear to support the contention that surgery alone leaves a permanent injury at some level. And then apparently the Hawkins case. But the Hawkins case, again, was a case where the victim appeared before the court, and the jury got a chance to observe the injury, and it was described as a big, highly visible injury that was not a thin hairline scar. It was a half inch or inch wide highly visible injury, and he was testifying, the victim testifies, and I have here 11 months after the trial, after my injury, I'm still suffering stomach pain. So there was some basis in that case for a rational trier of fact, and in the Hawkins case, to conclude that the person had suffered permanent physical injury. There is no basis in this case, and there is no case law that says merely undergoing a surgery, well, there, we just know logically there has to be a scarring in it that it's going to be permanent. We don't know that, and if we do create such a presumption, well, that effectively writes out the permanent and significant injury requirement of from the statute. Now, that's really certainly not the province of the court to be just saying, well, we presume in the case of any time the injury skin is broken that there's going to be some kind of scarring. We didn't actually see the scarring at trial, but we're going to presume in this case, because we know from logic that usually some kind of permanent injury results or scarring, we're going to assume it was present in this case too. That's simply not the case law of this Commonwealth. It's not the case law, and no rational trier of fact could have reached this conclusion. There plainly was an insufficiency of the evidence. Certainly the judge, when there was the motion to reconsider afterwards, he cites as his reasoning for he says, well, when you handle a weapon in close proximity to other people and you fire it and you leave a mark on the or a scar on another person in the area of their face or neck, that to the court is aggravated malicious wounding. Is that the case law in this Commonwealth?
Is there any evidence of a scar?
The only evidence, the totality of the evidence was Detective Kerry O'Donnell goes out to see the victim at the hospital 32 days after the incident and says, I took these pictures of the padding covering up the scar. And then she says, sometime after that, not sure exactly when, but a few days after, sometime after, she didn't really narrow it down to a time frame, I saw her again without the thing, and I saw that there were stitching or some kind of staples. And that's the totality of evidence about the permanent and significant injury. And so the judge and the Commonwealth argued, and the judge accepted that reasoning that, well, if there were staples and there was or there were some kind of stitches that the detective saw, that means it must have been a permanent scar from it. Some kind of scar must have happened. We never saw it. Nobody ever. But that's a presumption. It's unsupported by any case law that you just can presume that any injury that breaks the skin leaves some kind of permanent scar. Anytime, there's no presumption, no case law says if a person has a stapled injury or a stitches put into an injury, the court, a rational trier of fact, can presume that without ever seeing the injury, that it left a permanent
scar. Well, you know, you're into your rebuttal time, but you can keep going.
Thank you.
Ms. Campbell? Ms. Campbell, let me just ask you right out of the box. Would you agree that not every shooting, stabbing, cut, or wound necessarily equates to a permanent and significant physical impairment?
Yes, Your Honor.
In that case, what is it about, and would you also agree that not every scar equates to a permanent and significant physical impairment?
The second question, I think, is a little slightly more conditional in that.
Well, it's straightforward. The operative word being every. In other words, certainly it can be evidence of significant and permanent physical impairment, but I have a scar here on my thumb that I got when I was 12 years old in the Boy Scouts, and I would suggest that I'm not terribly physically impaired by having that.
Mentally, but physically.
But, yeah, I knew he wouldn't keep quiet about that.
I think it is fact-dependent, Your Honor.
I mean, just to take that one step further, common sense, which the court has said can be applied to these kinds of cases. Common sense tells us that every time you end up with a hole in your body that the good Lord didn't put there, there is going to be, at least for some period of time, visible evidence of that. It may heal completely and never, you couldn't ever see it again, or it may leave a scar that is insignificant, or it may leave a scar that is pretty obvious and an impairment. How do we know what we're dealing with here?
So the Commonwealth is not arguing that every single gunshot wound would leave a permanent and significant injury or scar. But what we have in this case is a gunshot wound that was serious. The evidence in this case is that the gunshot wound was bleeding heavily, that there was an entrance wound on her neck in close proximity to her face, and what the officer testified we believed was an exit wound on her lower back. There also is pictures of both wounds in the bandages on both wounds in the appendix.
Well, but let me point you to the language of the statute, which requires, and I'll just quote it, is caused to suffer permanent and significant physical impairment. That's a conjunctive there, not a disjunctive. So it's got to be both, permanent and significant. You've conceded that not every shooting equates to that. Clearly, a victim could testify to their degree of impairment because they're going to experience it firsthand. Certainly, a medical doctor or physician expert of some sort could do the same. We have neither here. We have pure speculation, essentially argued by the Commonwealth at trial, that because she was shot and required surgery, ergo, there must have been a permanent significant physical impairment, and focused on the fact that surgery leaves a scar. That was essentially the argument at trial.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the Commonwealth does not believe it's speculation. It's an inference from the totality of all the facts that were proven. The facts of immediately at the scene, the wound that was bleeding heavily.
But granting that surgery was done, granting that surgery often leaves a scar, that does not necessarily mean that the surgery and the scar equates to permanent and significant physical impairment as a matter of law, does it? Without testimony by somebody to link the injury to some degree of impairment. How are they impaired? How are they not able to do their daily life functions? You know, they can't move their arm properly. You know, they can't walk without a limp, that sort of thing. We have none of that here.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that the facts of this case, and it is a fact-dependent question, is that, and the trial court pointed out, the very close proximity to the victim's face. This was going to be a scar that it was right at her neck in close proximity to her face. And the trial court, as sitting as the fact finder, they found that that was going to be a significant impairment to her.
From looking at the pictures, I'm not too sure she is concerned with her physical appearance around her neck. Let me put it that way.
Point well taken, Your Honor.
But the point, let's say that, you know, it's clearly that the trial court did draw that inference. The question is whether that's a reasonable inference to draw from the evidence. And so, from what I understand the record, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I gather all the trial court saw was what we saw in those pictures.
Yes, sir.
The bandage. We can't see under the bandage. We don't know, you know, what the wound actually looks like. We don't know what the scar ultimately will look like, because at that time the scar there was no scar. There was still an open wound there. The healing process had not been completed. We don't know anything about that other than to speculate about it, which I would suggest is pretty much what the trial court did here, to speculate.
Did the evidence establish how long she was in the hospital?
Yeah.
Wasn't it a number of days?
It was at least 30 days, Your Honor, based on the shooting occurring on June 15th, and then the officer, when he visits, and he writes the date on the bandages that he's taking the photographs, and that's July 17th.
I would assume that it would be reasonable for a trial court, or jury for that matter, to conclude that anybody that spends 30 days in the hospital has received a significant injury.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I believe that is one of the inferences that the trial court was able to make. And when you look at the totality of the circumstances and the facts that were proven in evidence in this case, that this case...
But it's not just injury. The statute doesn't say injury. It says impairment. In other words, I could be injured. Judge Petty falls off bikes all the time, we learned earlier today. And he gets injured. Fortunately for him, he seems to land on his head a lot. But no, the point is you heal. I mean, you get back up on the bike. You might have to take a few days off, or 30 days off, or 6 months off. But eventually, you're not impaired. You're going on about your business as per normal. And so you can have a significant. It's not a significant injury that matters. It's a significant impairment. You can have a significant injury and ultimately not be impaired at all, can't you? Hypothetically,
yes, Your Honor.
You mentioned earlier that you did not believe that every gunshot constitutes aggravated malicious wounding, does not meet this test here. And I think you started to say there was evidence that there was significant bleeding in this case and maybe some other. What exactly is it about this particular wound that differentiates it from any other type of gunshot wound?
Certainly, Your Honor. The Commonwealth isn't suggesting that this case needs to make a statement that every gunshot wound is going to create a permanent and significant injury. However, in this case, it's not a case where the bullet just grazed the victim and did not cause her to have to go to a trauma center and spend a significant amount of time in the hospital and receive stitches and a lot of significant bleeding occurred at the scene. That's what this case is. However,
what differentiates that from any other gunshot wound? I mean, every gunshot wound, other than perhaps a graze, is going to cause some degree of significant bleeding. I mean, I think that's pretty much a given. Every gunshot wound, other than a grazing wound, is probably going to land you in the hospital, at least for some period of time. But not every gunshot wound is going to leave you with an impairment. That means you're some issue with your life or bodily functions after you leave the hospital.
Certainly, Your Honor. The Commonwealth would submit that a gunshot wound, the close proximity to your face that goes into your neck and out of your back, is going to leave you with, it is a reasonable inference for the trial court to determine.
What impairment? What impairment did it leave? What bodily function, what was the impairment?
The trial court found that it was a reasonable inference that there was going to be a significant scar close to her face and for a woman.
So it's your position that the scar itself is the only thing that constituted the impairment here. There's no reasonable inference you could draw that there was any internal injuries, that she would, you know, suffer some kind of loss of bodily function, anything like that.
I believe from this record.
And of course, the trial court based that conclusion not on actually looking at the wound, but by looking at the photographs of the bandages over the wound.
By looking at the photographs of the bandages and listening to the detective's testimony about observing the bandages, and then later.
So what would the fact finder, in this case the court, have based a reasonable conclusion that whatever's under that bandage is both permanent and significant?
The detective also testified that she saw after the bandages were removed that there was significant, there was staples and stitches there. And I believe that the trial court, a reasonable inference from that coupled with the prior evidence we've discussed, can lead the trial court to the inference that there was going to be a significant scar there, which would be a permanent impairment based on.
But is there, what medical evidence supports that conclusion? That would be my question. I mean, is the trial judge a medical expert? I mean,
no, Your Honor.
That I'm aware of.
I think it's a. However, I don't think you need to be. I do not believe fact finder needs to be a medical expert.
It seems to me somebody, and I can't imagine who it would be other than either a medical expert or the victim, him or herself, needs to testify as to how they have been impaired. How their bodily, as Judge Petty just put it, how their lifestyle has been altered by this particular injury. That's what the General Assembly intended to punish. That's why it's aggravated malicious wounding. It's because it's something that doesn't go away. It's both significant and permanent. Now, you know, a wound to the neck depends, I guess it largely would depend on what organs it transected. In other words, if it hit your vocal cords, and as a result, you couldn't speak for the rest of your life, or couldn't speak properly for the rest of your life, I think that solves the problem. But whereas, you know, you don't just assume from looking at a bandage taped over a wound that something that under that bandage is enough of an injury that it's going to be both significant in the sense that it's going to be ugly and obvious for the rest of that person's life, and also impair their ability to conduct their daily lives in some way, shape, or form.
The Commonwealth would submit on these facts that a gunshot wound that close proximity to your face, it is a reasonable inference that scar is going to significantly impact your lifestyle.
How is other than being ugly, let's just grant that it's something under that bandage is going to heal and become an ugly scar. How is that going to impair that individual for the rest of her life?
It's a scar that...
Is she not going to be able to turn her head? Is she not going to be able to nod her head? Is she not going to be able to speak? You know, we don't know.
Unfortunately, we do not know based on that and on this record, Your Honor.
And it has to be specific to this victim. And this is, you know, this woman has all kinds of tattoos around her neck. She's not a runway fashion model that makes her living on her beauty. And to say that she now has a scar in addition to all of these tattoos around her neck seems to be a stretch to think that might somehow significantly impair her lifestyle.
She might not be able to get a tattoo on a scar. I know that's not in the record either.
There you go.
You got us there.
Touche.
So perhaps it would be worse for this defendant. And the Commonwealth would just submit that when you're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, the standard is plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. And there is evidence in this record that this gunshot wound was significant and would leave this woman impaired.
One last question.
Yes.
I assume, it doesn't matter, I guess, but I assume that based on Mr. Hayden's comments that this case would have to go back for retrial if we reversed on the issue of the aggravated malicious wounding.
It does sound like that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Turning to the other assignment of error based on the identity, I think other than just the victim's sister's testimony, the detective also testified about the identification and how she came up with the defendant as a suspect, and ultimately she personally observed the victim's sister, who was an eyewitness, identify the defendant via a photo lineup.
That also came in without objection.
It was objected to based on hearsay, and it was overruled. And
it's not an issue before us, I guess. Is
yes, really Your Honor.
Getting at.
So based on both of those statements, the Commonwealth would submit that the defendant's identity is well established by the record as the shooter of the victim. And if the court has no further questions, the Commonwealth would request that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayden, anything else?
Normal tendency is to try to beat an issue into the ground. But in this case, I'm going to try and show some restraint.
Your restraint is appreciated.
It certainly is. We will come down and greet counsel and take